This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we are gearing up for Independence Day tomorrow. So welcome to a special hour of Radio Boston. This year, it feels like we're living through history. The coronavirus pandemic, a momentous presidential election, and mass protests over racism and policing that have made us more aware of the ways in which our past shapes us now. So today, we bring you stories and interviews on the African-American and Black experience in America, with an eye toward history. We spend time in the kitchen with African-American chef and poet L. Simone Scott as she shows us how she absorbed a rich history and tradition from her great-grandmother. Jazz musician Wynton Marsalis talks about his own discovery of a musical heritage and helps us understand that music better. But let's begin with 1619, the date when the first slaves were brought here from Africa. They were captured from a Portuguese slave ship and landed at Port Comfort in the Virginia colony, becoming the first African slaves on the English-controlled mainland of America. Last year, on the 400th anniversary of that landing, the New York Times launched the 1619 Project, a series of articles, essays, and other works to change our collective understanding of our history, and to make 1619 a foundational date for America as much as 1492, when Columbus sailed here from Europe, or 1776, when we declared independence. Khalil Gibran Muhammad wrote an essay for that project about the history of the sugar industry and the slave trade. He's a professor of history, race, and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. We spoke with him. And with Kelly Carter Jackson. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Africana Studies at Wellesley College and author of Force and Freedom, Black Abolitionists and the Politics of Violence. When we spoke with them last August, I asked Kelly why she believes the 1619 Project made such an impact.
I think that Americans in particular are obsessed with their identity. I think that we've always been fascinated with the past because the past is a roadmap, not just to our present, but to our future. And so for me, it's always exciting to see people that want to engage with the past and want to know more about what made this country possible and what made this country profitable, but also what aspects of our history are really problematic and really troubling and how do we reckon with that. I hope more Americans are wanting to do the hard work of understanding American history.
Let's take a call. Sarah from Cambridge, go ahead.
Hi, thanks so much. 1619 Project is just incredible. I did a PhD on African studies in Senegal particularly, and I wanted to ask both of the speakers today whether or not they thought it would be helpful in how we talk about slavery and the origin of slavery here in the United States within the context of how blacks sold blacks, particularly West Africa, lots of there's about hierarchy and power. And I wonder if framing it that way would be helpful in just getting to racial reconciliation between whites and blacks, understanding that it was very much about commerce and that this notion of what is white and what is black is obviously a social construct. It was really about commerce and about hierarchy and about power.
Sarah, thanks for that call. Khalil, I'll turn to you because commerce is core to your essay on the sugar industry. What's your answer to Sarah's question?
Well, I think it's a good reminder of the complexities that underlie this half millennia of history. There have been ongoing debates that we've seen play out in social media and in some conservative responses to the 1619 Project, which echo some of what the caller just mentioned, and that is that that Africans sold their own into slavery, and so why aren't we talking about that? And what worries me is not that our history is even more complicated with regard to the relationship of commerce and industry, of the actual profiting from the coerced labor of others, but that these tend to be gotcha games in an effort to diffuse the basic narrative of this project, which is what do we need to know to understand the United States of America better? And in that sense, the project hits the nail on the head for the most part. We certainly expect our classrooms to be responsible for world history, for global history, to tell the backstory for how those ships left Portugal and Spain in the first place on their way to West African and Central African countries. So it's not to say that it's one or the other. It is most certainly both. But the context in which we're having a conversation about both often is framed in a, polemics of racism in America is not so bad after all.
Kelly, you nodded so many times that I was going to ask another question, but let me come to you first.
Sure. I get this question all the time, and I think a better question to answer or ask is, who benefited the most? Who profited the most? Who made the most out of this institution? Who prolonged this institution the most? And I think that when you ask those particular questions, all fingers don't necessarily point back to Black Africans. They point back to these European colonial powers and how they constructed their own societies, how they become world leaders, industrial powers, is because of the systems that they profited from. That, to me, is most important.
Khalil, one of the things that really struck me about your sugar essay was the idea that, in fact, sugar itself, the way it exists in our country, couldn't have without slavery, if I'm not overstating it. Am I overstating it? And can you talk a bit more about that?
Not at all. I mean, so there's history and then there's what might have happened. So the what might have happened part of this is that in other parts of the world, sugar might have been cultivated at a level that would have made it a cheap commodity for world export, in which case some other part of the globe would have been responsible. But as it happened, it was precisely Christopher Columbus in the late 15th century that brought sugar, or cane more particularly, to South America and Central America. And as such, sugar proliferated. Now, it both proliferated because the environment made that possible, but also because of the ability to cultivate it with enslaved labor. Enslaved labor was already happening in the Mediterranean region, but on a scale in combination with a land that was stolen and expropriated by indigenous people, and then this massive trade in human bodies of enslaved Africans, all made sugar essentially a very cheap commodity that would build up the literal financial wealth of the North American colonies owned by Britain, and made possible Wall Street as a central financial capital by the early 18th century.
Part of the really intense pushback and criticism of this project seems to be a reaction to an argument that 1619 is so meaningful that, in fact, it's the actual founding date of the country. Former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, who used to teach history at West Georgia College, which is now West Georgia University, has been really critical of the project. He argued on Fox that thousands of white Americans died in the Civil War for the cause of ending slavery, and that saying slavery is the defining force of American history is, quote, propaganda and a lie. He is far from the only person criticizing the 1619 Project. Kelly, do you think, I'm just going to be honest, did positing the 1619, that it should essentially replace 1776 as sort of the founding moment of our country, push people, especially white people, too far and weaken the message? Or was it absolutely necessary to put that stake in the ground?
I think it's absolutely necessary to put that stake in the ground. I think that there has been a lot of willful amnesia, selective amnesia, in terms of how people want to remember America. And people want to see America as all good and all great and a land of opportunity. And part of that story can still be true, but I think we also have to acknowledge the ugly side of America and the fact that racism in this country has been a cancer that we have been sort of refusing to treat and refusing to deal with. And I think, you know, if we were to look at racism as a cancer, we can't say, oh, no, don't talk about cancer. That's too negative. You've got such a great smile. You know, like, you know, you would want to focus.
Well, when you put it that way.
But you would want to focus on how do we attack this cancer? And I think that's what historians, you know, their role is to sort of remind people of the past and show them a useful present and a useful and a possible future forward. And so it's really important that we talk about 1619 as the founding, not just of the United States, but of North America in general. I think it's a good framework for how we understand how countries and powers are formed.
Let's take another call. We've got Jan from Bellingham on the line. Jan, go ahead.
To me, Reconstruction is a perfect example of the fallout of what happened in 1619. It could have gone one way, but because by then we had established these mental images of people who were slaves and what white people would lose if those people gained power, Reconstruction turned out to, you know, lead to Jim Crow. Now we have mass incarceration. I'm a white person. I think most white people just don't see the history. And I think you got to start from the beginning.
Jen, thanks so much for that. And that is central to Khalil's work. So, Khalil, let me turn to you and invite you to respond.
Well, I want to say that history is not passive in this. I mean, the provocation that 1619 should be the origin story and the origin date for the United States is just that. It's a provocation. If we were all historically literate, if our classrooms from K to 12 were teaching history in the way that academic historians have been writing about for the past 50 years, then this would be a minor note. The fact is we've been playing political footsie with the true history of our country precisely because it was rooted in the basic treatment of 20% of the population that fundamentally contradicted the very basis upon which the nation was founded. So this project invites us to have an educated conversation about the nature of this country and the future of this country based on a more honest, accurate, and truthful telling of that history. Some people will start at zero. Other people will start with a very sophisticated understanding. But even those that start with a sophisticated understanding, like Newt Gingrich, will still attempt to distort what this project actually does in favor of a political agenda that is about saying America can do no wrong. It is simply a God-divine country that is exceptional and unlike any other place on earth.
All right, the lines are full, so let's take some calls. Rob from Cambridge, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm a first-generation American, and my family on both sides didn't come here voluntarily. And what I'm trying to figure out is, how do people who came here way after slavery, or let's say somebody who just was just admitted to the country, how do they think about slavery?
There we go. And I'm going to add one more call in, and then I'm going to invite Kelly to answer those questions. Pat from Watertown, please go ahead.
The article that I've read from the 1619 Project, and thank you to everybody for all your work, that most struck me was Wesley Morris's article about minstrelsy as the beginning of American entertainment. And I think the difference between American slavery and other slaveries historically is in 1830, you have white Irish people in New York starting to create this image, which becomes the dominant image of popular culture as African Americans, as not just slaves, but as subhuman.
Thanks for that, Pat. All right. So I wanted to get a couple calls. I almost wish I'd sort of taken this separately because I want to make sure we do justice to both of them. So first, Kelly, Rob says, if you came to this country, like his family did, involuntarily or significantly later, mm-hmm. how could one think about slavery? Let me give you that question.
Sure. I think we need to think about the system itself and how power works and how race works in particular in America. It's very easy to see how slavery was wrong and evil and problematic, how segregation was wrong. But we don't often look at the corollary aspect of that is, how did racism benefit people? How did segregation benefit people? How did white Americans get advantaged through their whiteness? There's an unwillingness as well to sort of look at how white people benefit. And I think there's even controversy of even how we use the phrase privilege. It's not about wealth, but it's about how you are able to move through society, how you're able to have access to certain things simply because of the color of your skin. If you come to this country and you are of African descent, you're going to have a completely different experience than someone who comes to this country who is of European descent. And those differences need to be talked about and fleshed out.
Okay, and Khalil, to Pat's question, which I'm kind of struggling to summarize, so I'm going to hope I don't need to, and that you're going to be able to jump right in. Great.
I haven't heard enough about Wesley Morris's great essay, so I want to invite your listeners to read it because it hasn't gotten the attention it deserved. In some ways, it is the third leg of this three-pronged foundation that the project focuses on, and that is that if you just take one gigantic step back, you can't understand America's wealth, its political systems, and its culture without understanding the presence of those enslaved Africans, period. And therefore, what Wesley Morris reminds us is that Irish immigrants themselves found their American home through the appropriation of the black experience. Immigrants today owe it to themselves to understand the history of the country, which cannot be understood without understanding the presence of black people and the period of slavery to Jim Crow to our present.
Kelly, you teach. Will this project inform your future curriculum.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are so many essays that I was like, oh, I could put this on my syllabus. I could put this on my syllabus, you know. I think the 1619 Project is just going to be a treasure trove for a long time to come.
And Khalil, obviously you wrote one of the essays, but will you teach other parts of it in your curriculum as well?
It's on the syllabus already.
Excellent.
it makes my job so much easier, let me tell you, definitely.
Khalil Gibran Muhammad is a professor of history, race, and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Kelly Carter Jackson is an assistant professor in the Department of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. I really appreciate you being here. Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, understanding the legacy of jazz music with legendary artist Wynton Marsalis. I'm Tiziana Dearing. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. We are looking today at three stories of African-American and Black experiences in our country as we approach Independence Day. We just heard about 1619 as a foundational date for America. Next, we turn to one part of what African-Americans created on this continent, jazz. That's legendary musician and composer Wynton Marsalis. He credits his father and a slate of artists who came before him for inspiring his love for jazz and respect for its traditions. Wynton Marsalis is one of the most prolific and respected jazz artists of the 20th century, and his recorded works are incredibly diverse, ranging from original composition to new recordings of classic swing, to reimagined children's songs. He's also the managing and artistic director for jazz at Lincoln Center and the leader of its orchestra. We spoke with Wynton Marsalis ahead of a performance at Boston Symphony Hall. He described it as almost a homecoming for him, as Boston was a big part of his journey to discover his passion.
When I first came, I was 17. I had no sense, really, of first the breadth and depth of jazz, let alone symphonic music and the different experiences that I had, the students I met there, and to be a part of the tradition of Tanglewood and the Boston Symphony. And it was a great trumpet tradition with Armando Gitala and Roger Voisin, and to meet other great musicians in the Boston Symphony. And at that time, Gunther Schuller was conducting and running the Berkshire Music Center. He became a mentor of mine. I learned all kinds of things from him. I played under Bernstein there. We played Prokofiev Fifth. I met trumpet players and colleagues that I have to this day. Just, it was such a new world. And Tanglewood was a place of such quality and so many great musicians. And it's a great tradition which goes all the way back to Koussevitzky and Bartok and the music he wrote and the conducting workshops. I could go on and on and on, and the impact it had on me as a musician and a student, understanding what serious musicianship was about. And not that I didn't know that, because my father's a musician and somebody who is a teacher and studied and played and believed in practicing and all those things. So I grew up around serious musicians. But to see a lot of younger musicians really serious about playing and to meet that range of people was a defining point in my life.
Let's forward now in your career. You've been incredibly prolific, released a wide range of recordings. You've done classical compositions. There was a stretch where you produced, in 1999, something like 10 records in a single year. And then there was a stretch around 2010 for a while where you didn't record a lot. What accounts for the kinds of ebbs and flows for you of that? I don't want to say productivity, because I suspect that you were plenty productive. You just weren't recording as much during that time.
Well, I've always been recording, so we just haven't put records out. So all through 2010, 11, 12, we're making recordings the whole time. As a matter of fact, now we're in the process of releasing 100 records in 5 years.
So, oh, my gosh.
We've released six already this year. And I think we released Betty Carter, Jazz for Kids, which we just put out here as nursery rhymes and songs with new, fresh arrangements, different kind of look at music we all know, everything from Itsy Bitsy Spider. To the wheels on the bus go round and round.
And what made you decide to do it that way? Record for a long time and then release for a long time?
Well, I just go with what the opportunities are and what is, the recordings are less commercial products for me. Then they are statements of our art and where it is. Not just me, all of us now end up dealing with our orchestra, Jazzy Lincoln Center Orchestra. We work on a lot of music together. We have 10 arrangers. So we produce a lot of music in a very short time. And some years we've done 8, 9 original shows of music that never existed. So
incredible.
If you put the fact that we've been working together basically 20-something years, you have a sense of how much music we actually have and new music. So, and I was also waiting just for the time that I felt the culture needed for us to be very definitive. And I think that this is a point, this is time for us to be extremely definitive.
What do you mean by the culture needs you to be very definitive?
We all have an umbilical cord that we're attached to. And it's very easy for you to get so caught up in your own magnificence that you lose sight of that cord. People who are in my age, it's interesting age for us because that's when your parents start to pass away and, you start to experience things you really didn't think of. And you start to question things, fundamental things like what is home? If your mother passes away, your father passes away, it's something you may have taken for granted that was central to who you are as a person. When you get into the age when that begins to happen, or you start to have grandchildren, or you start to consider very fundamental things in a very primal and active way. So a culture has to do that also. Nations have to do that. And we are certainly at that point in our country where we've lost sight of who we are.
Does the practice of jazz and the presence of jazz offer an opportunity to reunite, to bring people back together in collaboration and improvisation at a time when we need it?
It does, but it's an earned collaboration. You understand that a part of your critique is also yourself. So if I'm critiquing something in our culture, I have to also critique myself. And when you collaborate with other people, other people's expertise and knowledge helps you also to define yourself. And it's important when jazz teaches you to respect how much other people know, how creative another person is, whether you agree with them or not. Because we can come around the common goal of swinging, the things we want to do are subsumed by our search for common ground. If that common ground is serious, hey, you could come up with something. But as Jelly Roll Martin, the great first composing intellectual of jazz, observed when he was in the Tenderloin District of New Orleans, you saw all kind of people there because it didn't really take a credential to be down at the bottom. So people could come together to go up high, or they could go down low and find each other too.
Let's listen specifically to a piece of music. This is Blue Twirl off of Jazz and Art. Us through the definitive in this piece. What is the statement you're making or the cultural moment you're capturing in a piece like this?
First, that's a piece composed by Vincent Gardner, great trombonist in the Jazz Lincoln Center Orchestra, also is the artistic director of Jazz Houston, a nonprofit organization that supports jazz education and performance in Houston. That piece was inspired by Sam Gilliam's artwork. And it uses a progression of a standard song, but it has many time shifts, and we use elements of like Sam's way of putting paint on the canvas, and some sections are really abstract with us making different type of sounds and a low bass cue, and then we go into a progression and a swing, and Vince's music is always very layered. He always uses a lot of pyramids and kind of interlocking parts that sometimes are 30-second notes apart. So it's like, it'd be like eight horns playing that one line. And his music is arranging is very colorful. Probably the greatest arrangement any of us have played is Vincent's arrangement of Thelonious Monk's Light Blue. And that's one that we play for years. And whenever we hear it, we always say, man, we don't know how he heard that one. We just put out on Jazz for Kids, Vince has a recording of Rubber Ducky. That's one of the hardest damn arrangements to play. Boy, I must have practiced my part, just the layering of the parts, because the melody of Rubber Ducky is in a pep section a la Duke Ellington. I think if Duke heard it, he'd say, damn, is that how he heard? And he has all kind of underlying contrapuntal lines. And if you play the original Rubber Ducky, you'll see what Vincent Gardner does with his arrangements.
I love it that you have enough respect for what music can bring to children that you're going to put that kind of layering and challenge into Rubber Ducky.
I did an alphabet book for children called Jazz ABCs, and it had the biggest words in the world in it. And it goes through the ABCs, and it uses a different type of poem for each letter. Like some would be just free prose. Another one was a limerick. Another was a ballad and a pantoum. And I use different forms, and because I always love to hear little kids struggle to pronounce words that are bigger than the words they know. We need these five men to protect our building. You know, so I was imagining with that book just how important it is for us to always kind of have our kids reaching out in front of themselves and not feeling like a cell phone or something is going to teach them, and keeping them always striving for adulthood than having the other way around, having adults striving for childhood.
Let's look forward in the genre. I want to play a bit of a new age jazz artist. This is Crowned and Kissed by Esperanza Spalding. What's your reaction to that?
I like her. It's like sounds like an R&B song to me.
And how would you make the distinction? How do you make the distinction across these genres that seem to bleed together?
What the bass and drums play most of the time.
Can you explain that more? This is me asking. I'm so curious.
If the bass and drums are playing backbeat or groove-oriented music, punch, doodle-doom, chop, doodle-doom, doodle-doom, it's more like R&B. To me, that's not to say good or bad or to make a critique of her music at all. I'm critical of kind of larger cultural things, but I never critique a younger person's music. I'm merely describing what, to me, I listen to what bass and drums play, and they determine the style. Now, a musician can play a piece of jazz, a piece of R&B and jazz, or, you know, the pieces are all interchangeable, but most of the musicians, once they get to the kind of R&B grooves and the backbeat grooves, because that's what the public is most acclimated to hearing, they don't really go to anything swinging for too much.
Where do you think jazz is going next? What are you most excited about?
I'm excited about all the great young piano players that we have.
Any examples?
Like a young guy, Sean Mason, Joel Winhart, Miles Lennox, Joey Alexander, Isaiah Thompson, Micah Thomas, Robbie Lee. And whenever I hear them, I think, man, we have a lot of piano players out there that really can play and who are very, very serious. Those are the ones that I know and have heard, and I'm sure there are four or five other fantastic ones. And all of these, if you heard them play on a gig or something, they would blow your mind with the sophistication of their approach, the depth of their knowledge, their technical skills, their knowledge of jazz, and their willingness to play jazz.
With that in mind, for our young listeners who are aspiring musicians who may be hearing this, what piece of advice would you give them?
Stay in front of people and don't feel like you have to play down to people. People will come with you. It takes longer. But also never forget about people when you're constructing your music. Because if you could get so deep into your thing and it's so myopic and self-absorbed, I don't know. You don't make it so hard for me to follow you that I'm not going to do that. Give me some way to follow you.
Jazz musician Wynton Marsalis, thank you so much for joining us here on Radio Boston.
Yes, ma'am. It's such a pleasure.
Stay with us. Coming up, America's Test Kitchen's L. Simone Scott retells her family's history through poetry and lemon pound cake. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. All this hour, we've been learning about the African-American and Black experience in America. We began with the history of the first slaves brought to the English colonies in 1619, and heard from musician Wynton Marsalis about how he discovered jazz from his father and older artists. Next, we head into the kitchen with L. Simone Scott, the first African-American woman to be featured on PBS's America's Test Kitchen. She's also the founder of She Chef, a networking group for women of color in the food industry. We joined her in the kitchen at America's Test Kitchen headquarters in the Seaport earlier this year to learn a special family recipe.
I say all the time, and I'll repeat it today for the record, I'm not the best cook in my family. I'm just the one who pursued it professionally, you know, so I think we've always kind of grown up with an ownership in the kitchen, like know where everything is. We know how we take pride in saying, like, I make Granny's mac and cheese. Well, I make Granny's potato salad. You know, we own that. It's part of our heritage, you know.
Today we're making lemon pound cake, the very same pound cake that the best chef in Elle's family, her great grandmother, used to make for her. She was a big part of Elle's life. This year, Elle published a poem about her great-grandmother and this recipe for lemon pound cake. It's in a cookbook called Rage Baking, The Transformative Power of Flour, Fury, and Women's Voices. Elle participated in the book after she was asked by her mentor at the Food Network. The book was co-authored by two white women, Catherine Alfred and Kathy Gunst, but includes submissions and recipes from women chefs all over the country. Earlier this year, it received some negative attention for the use of the term rage baking in the title, which a Black woman, performance artist, and activist Tangerine Jones says she originally coined. But for Elle, this recipe and the poem she wrote to accompany it are not about rage baking. They're about honoring her great-grandmother's life and the story of her move north in the Great Migration.
My great-grandmother came here during the Great Migration. She didn't come first. She sent her children first. She sent her mother first, then her children. Then she came. And I was just imagining what she must have been feeling during a time where she needed to leave one region because of, you know, the way life was happening for Black people in the South, having to part from her children during that time. I can imagine she experienced a great amount of sadness and anger and frustration. And knowing her the way that I did, I'm pretty sure that she cooked her way through that.
What makes you think she cooked her way through that?
Because she cooked her way through everything, you know, like it was her profession, it was her passion, it was the thing that she shared with family. And she was just good at it. Never trained, just a natural good cook. I think that's probably where I got it from. Like, I was cooking long before I was trained, but it was definitely the confidence that she displayed in the kitchen. Like, she moved like she was floating and, you know, and it definitely, you could see her mind was in another place. She was transplanted to a different place in time. So, you know, I know that it was not just an experience of putting food on the table for her, but it was emotional, it was political. I think it was all the things.
Is it the same for you?
Now that I'm getting older and I'm dealing with food on a different level, I was recently selected to be part of James Beard Foundation Boot Camp for Social Policy and Change, where I'm very passionate about the SNAP program in this country. And I mean, having been a recipient of such, I think it is definitely now moving into a political space for me and thinking about the way people eat in my neighborhoods. I didn't particularly grow up in a food desert, but I grew up around food deserts, you know, and thinking about how, you know, Black people eat is very important to me. So it's definitely becoming way more political now.
I grew up in a really big family. Mm-hmm. There was not enough room in the bedrooms for all the kids, but my grandmother had a little apartment in our house, and I lived in her apartment with her. My grandfather died the year I was born, mm-hmm. and so those first few years when she was very lonely, she cooked all the time, and I cooked with her, and I learned how to, the cooking I learned how to do, I learned in those early years.
Yeah.
The bond that your poem evokes got me in my gut.
Oh, I'm so glad you felt that.
I did. And it made, I think, both of us wonder, you could have written anything. You wrote this, it's a good poem.
Thank you.
So why a poem?
Well, I'm a poet. I'm a writer. That's probably my very first passion. It was the first thing that I pursued. I was a part of the spoken word community in Detroit where I grew up. You know, sometimes I think poetry is a very consolidated way to give a large message. You know, like the story of the Great Migration from the South to the North is a common story. It's the story of hundreds of thousands of people, you know. And so what way can I tell this story from my family's perspective? All of those parts actually even encompass everything about my grandmother and her siblings. You know, those are real parts. The poem says, George will enlist. My uncle George went to the army. He was the oldest of four, three sisters and a brother. He did enlist into the army shortly after moving to Michigan. And my grandmother's the oldest of the sisters, but they called her Lissa, which is short for little sister. But she was the oldest, and she was very much into cooking. And then the babies, they were too young to really know what was going on. So she was the one who helped in the kitchen. You know, she will be your help in the kitchen. And so, you know, these are also just parts of the family that I know, part of the family history that I study even now. And, you know, I think poetry is something everyone can feel. And if you say it right or write it right, it doesn't just become the story of the Great Migration. It becomes the story of Holocaust survivors. It becomes the story of refugees, you know. And I think it was important for me to make sure that this poem could reach across platforms.
That moment in the poem when she packs up the food.
Yes.
I thought of refugees. I thought of modern day refugees.
Yeah.
I thought of that moment when you might,
getting chills.
Yeah. When you might, you know, send your child out into God knows what.
Yes.
And the last thing that you can do for them besides hug and kiss them is give them sustenance.
Yeah, because, you know, food and cooking are exercises in muscle memory, right? We associate food smells, food flavors with different parts of our lives, you know, like to this day, my grandmother has been, has passed away almost 6 years now. Even now, when I walk into a room where Thanksgiving cooking is being prepared and I smell sage, it hits me like a truck, you know, it jars all of the emotions. And I think a part of that was not just sending them with a meal, but sending them with something that they can remember where they came from. They will remember this experience, and they will know when they taste that meal again, mom's coming, I have family here, they can do it too. Like, this is how we create familiarity when you're going into a place that you're not familiar with.
You started the poem with her name.
Yes.
Will you say it?
Anne.
I was thinking about when I talk about my Nona or my mom. Yeah. I don't say their names first. I say my Nona or my mom. And
yes.
Then later I might say Irene or Carla. But you started with her name.
Yes.
Why?
I think it's important that we say the names of our ancestors, you know, or say the names of the people who've paved the way for us. And I just thought it was important to start off with people knowing this person is not just this experience. This person has a name. This person has a family, you know. I think we get lost in that. We use the word the words refugee, we use the words immigrant, you know, but we forget sometimes that these people have names, you know, they have families, and we should say it.
The book is called Rage Baking. Many of the people in the book bake out their anger.
Yes.
The poem and your great-grandmother's story on its surface does not appear to be a story of anger.
Yes.
I have to imagine there was some part of her that was angry every day.
I'm very sure there was parts of her that were angry every day. I mean, in the South, you know, during the time in the 20s, you know, she was born in 1911. So she was feeling the brunt of most things as a teenager, you know, and Jim Crow was happening during that time. And, you know, people could get incarcerated, like a black person could be incarcerated just off of the verbal testimony of a person who probably wasn't even present, you know, and that could be the fate of her husband or her father or her brothers, you know. And I can imagine that living in fear every day probably would cause you to also be angry every day, you know, and let alone moving into the time of the Depression where you can't even make enough money to live. You can't own property because everything is unreachable, untouchable. You know, like I feel frustrated if I want to cook something at home and one of my ingredients is not there. And I'm like, I got to go to the grocery store. But like, imagine your basic needs being just unreachable. You know, I'm sure she was angry a lot.
You know, my Nona was born in 1911.
Yeah.
And both sides of her family came to Michigan from Italy to resettle. So I'm just very struck.
Wow.
I'm just very struck by that.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So let's talk about the recipe.
Okay.
Why lemon pound cake?
Well, I think that pound cake is probably one of the more popular Southern recipes. And it was something she made lots of things well. She made banana pudding well. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I could cut to the chase and say it's probably the only recipe that I can make almost as good as she makes. I don't know that I feel comfortable trying the other things. I think I haven't had a banana pudding as good as hers since she was on this earth yet. Not me, not anyone else. Mm. She used to make a really good rum cake. And she was a very Christian woman. So imagine a good rum cake from a Christian woman. It was quite quite a paradox.
Quite good.
Yeah, it was quite good. But this pound cake, I think it represents her well.
Shall we bake?
Yeah, let's bake.
Cool. Making pound cake is not a simple task. The mixer is frequently running as we combine eggs, sugar, flour, butter, and of course, the lemon.
Ooh, that lemon. This makes me miss her so much. She'd be super proud of this cake.
In the room, it's almost as though Anne is there with us. And as we cook, we talk more about Anne and my grandmothers, Marion and Irene. Do you know what your earliest baking memory with her is?
Yes, my earliest baking memory with her was when I was about 8 years old. And she was making banana pudding, and I kept eating vanilla wafers. And she was like, if you don't stop eating those wafers, I'm not going to let you bake. And I immediately stopped. I wanted to stay in the kitchen, so not eating the wafers was very important.
So you were ready to resist temptation.
I was ready. I wanted to learn. No, I think I got it.
So the last of the flour, we're braving the bowl, and the last of the flour is going in.
It's going in. And I'm going to stop and just scrape the sides down one more time since we added a last bit of flour.
When this cake is done.
Yes.
I mean, you have a work day ahead of you.
Yes.
But at some point, I imagine you'll eat a piece.
Yes.
Will you sit quietly somewhere? Will you wait and take it home? And is there a cup of coffee or tea? Or will you just kind of cut a piece and eat it?
I think I'm going to honor and remember my grandmother and actually cut a piece and have it with a cup of coffee, like she and I used to do back in the day. I've been drinking coffee for a lot of years, thanks to my grandmother. I'm pretty sure I'm the youngest person in the family. I was the youngest person in the family drinking coffee every morning.
I learned to drink coffee really early because the women in my family would sit around the kitchen table with a cup of coffee and talk.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be included in that.
Isn't that amazing how some of us decide that that inclusion is really important to us and some don't really care, you know, and it's not to slight, you know, their respect or honor or, you know, anything for tradition or for, you know, the elders. But, like, some of us choose it and some of us don't, you know. And our memories are very different for those who choose it. very different, you know, our experiences, the way we cook, the way we tell the family stories. For those of us who chose to be there during that time, learn a lot. I learned a lot about being a matriarch and problem solving, you know, how to help. To this day, I'm one of the most, I'm like the neutral person in my family. Like, people come to me about their secrets, their problems, and I'm going to taste some of this batter.
Can I taste it? Mm-hmm. Tasting the batter feels to me like an important part of the...
Oh, wow.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Mm. It's like... explosion of sugar, explosion of lemon, explosion of butter.
Oh, all the important things in life.
Is it bad that there's a piece of me that just wants to sit down with a spoon in that bowl?
Not at all. Not at all. That was the other part of my young baking experiences. This is a smooth batter. I get my humility from my great-grandmother, can you tell? All right, I'm going to give this a pound on the table so we can get any air bubbles out. So I'm going into the oven now. Will you grab the oven door for me?
I will.
Okay.
Yep.
All right, we're all set.
With the lemon pound cake in the oven, we sit down. Elle reads us the poem she wrote with the recipe about her great-grandmother's journey and the Great Migration.
Mother dear, Anne, Mississippi morning, sunrises bore burning crosses and separate lives. Mother dear put her babies on that train north, dressed in Sabbath best. Shoebox of chicken, lemon pound cake, and notes to mama and cousin. Take care of my babies. Margie will be your kitchen help. George will enlist soon. Edith will need hugs but can pick the collards. I'll be heading north whether husband comes or not. See y'all soon, Annie. First winter north. Crowd of peas boil, windows steaming. Detroit, black bottom, wrong side of the tracks, life. Gospel, Mahalia, Leontine, opera. Christmas, pine tree aroma, and Mother Dear's train has entered the station. Annie here, gifts from the south. Quilts with names, family albums, coconut cake, mama's dinner rolls, and lemon pound cake.
How do you feel?
Sad, oddly, you know?
I do.
I miss her, and so much gets lost when the ancestors go, you know? Well, they say when an ancestor dies, it's like a library burns to the ground. And it just reminds me how I didn't ask all the questions. Like, I have so many more questions, you know? But I'm proud to be able to have her name and her legacy published. It's an honor, you know? You don't get that very often, you know? So one less library will burn down, you know?
And it's a gift to the rest of us.
Thank you.
Elle Simone Scott, thank you for letting us cook with you today and learn so much about your family, your heritage.
It was a pleasure. Thank you. Thanks, Anne.
Elle Simone Scott is the first African-American woman to be featured on PBS's America's Test Kitchen. She's also the founder of She Chef, a networking group for women of color in the food industry. We'll have a recipe for her great-grandmother's lemon pound cake at RadioBoston.org.
I'll be seeing you in all the old familiar places.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.
I'll be looking at the moon, but I